From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Ella Joy Olson's novel, Ivy Bagrin is trying to move past the unexpected death of her husband, Adam. But she's paralyzed with grief. Her brother tells her it's time to get her house in order, in all the meanings of that expression. So she turns to the house itself, her time-worn red brick bungalow on Downington Avenue in Sugar House. She knows that Adam loved the weight of the old house, and he was always looking for clues to the lives lived before they moved in. Olson's novel is about five women she imagines lived in the bungalow. And maybe you've done the research on your own house. Maybe you've always wanted to. Maybe you found an artifact, a news clipping, a letter. Today in the program, we're asking what difference it makes to know the history of your house. Join us after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, Abe Shaw was doing some renovations on his old house in Salt Lake City, and he found some things, some artifacts tucked away in a wall. His wife, Sarah, heard about our show today, and she sent us a note and a photo of the things. An old envelope from 1910. There was a mail-order dress catalog, a pair of scissors, a spool of pink thread. Nothing valuable, really, but they were clues. And Sarah said it got them wondering and wanting to know more. Maybe a seamstress had lived in the house. And this is a familiar scenario for people who live in old houses, finding random objects and trying to connect them to the life of the place. It's what Ivy and Adam do in Ella Joy Olson's novel. The book is set here in Salt Lake, in Sugar House, actually, on Downington Avenue, to be exact. Ivy and Adam had done their share of work on their old house in the 14 years that they had lived there. Adam said he had touched nearly every pipe, 2x4, and outlet in the place. But as the novel begins, Adam is gone. He has died unexpectedly. And Ivy uses the stories she finds about five women who lived in the house kind of as a way to move past her grief. Today in the program, we're talking about Ella Joy Olson's novel and also the ideas behind it. We're asking what effect the story of your house has on your life. Ella Joy Olson is joining us. She's a novelist based here in Salt Lake, as I said. Her book is Root, Petal, Thorn. She has a second book that she's working on. We'll mention that a little bit later on the program. Ella's joining us here in the studio, and welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin. So this is your first novel.
This is my first novel, my debut.
Your debut, and kind of your first writing project, really? Big
yes.
one?
Yes, yeah. Yes, it was. I decided to try to teach myself to write, and at that time I thought I should try to write something that I know, at least that I can describe. Yeah. And so at that point I started kind of describing my home. I do live in a 100-year-old home. I live in Sugar House. And then the stories just came to me. I have to say that maybe they were probably 15 years in the making, because as I remodeled my own house, I liked to imagine the people that made the original changes that I was unceremoniously ripping out.
Right. I actually want to get back to that, just the idea of how much of this is ours. And look, let's ditch that, or, you know, and the guilt and the feelings that you feel about those things. But so essentially, on some level, it's not that you were Ivy. Obviously, the circumstances are quite different, but you went through a similar kind of process in the sense that you were wondering about the history of your house.
Yeah, wondering about the history of my home. My home, while it's old, the appraiser when we first bought it said that it was a home that had been loved through the decades. And I wondered exactly what he meant by that until I started doing the remodeling myself. And I realized that many of the things that I was taking out were things that people had put in and thought would be gorgeous in their houses for years to come.
Yeah.
So dropped ceilings, or they tore out woodwork, or wallpapered after wallpaper after wallpaper. And so as we remodeled through the house, I started thinking, who were the people that would do this? And what was going on in their lives during that time? Mm-hmm. So often I've looked out my own window and thought, what would the street have looked like when it was this house was new and these trees were tiny, and who would the people have been that lived in my home?
When did you come up with Ivy? When did she come to you as a character?
Well, strangely, she was the very last character
that
I wrote.
Right?
Yes. I started with the most historic character, Emmeline. I have always been a historical fiction fan. My great-grandma was a fantastic record keeper, and she wrote poetry and church speeches and things like that about her home and her neighborhood. And so I had a lot of really good nuggets of family history that I could weave into a fictional narrative. But then I ended up writing all the other historic characters, and I realized I needed, if I was going to write it as one book and have the home as a character of itself, I needed some way to tie these characters together.
Yeah.
And hence Ivy, and that's the reason for her name.
Yeah,
she intertwines the characters, and then that's when she started searching, and of course we found, you know, Easter eggs, we called them, discoveries in our own home about the things that people had purposefully or inadvertently left behind. So yes, she was the last. Although people do like to say, oh, you know, I'm quite certain that that's you. And in fact, my husband. I needed a catalyst. I needed a catalyst for the discoveries to occur. And one day we were at lunch and I said, I'm going to kill Adam. I'm sorry. That's just how books go. And he says, you're what? Yeah, he couldn't believe.
You had to kill off the husband.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that part of the story.
Okay.
So right at the beginning, Ivy she's basically, as I put it, paralyzed by grief.
Yes.
She can't budge, can't really move forward. And her brother, terrific character, Stephen, mm-hmm. finally kind of had enough. In some ways, he wants to help. And
right.
he makes a plan. He says, all right, we are going to make a plan to try to move beyond this grief. And he comes up with this action plan, 5 points. At least mm-hmm. it starts with five. And then he adds a sixth. Get your house in order.
Yes.
What does he mean?
Well, I think two things, probably. First of all, she was in the middle of remodeling projects, so there were tools and dust cloths and things all around the home. And she hadn't touched any of those, almost figuring that if she touched them, then he would never come back. And then also, she needed to move forward. And it was a gradual process, but the process of finishing those projects allowed her to, first of all, discover the stories of the other women who were in her home and realize she wasn't necessarily alone in her grief because, you know, everybody, one of the things that she says at the end is she realizes that everybody has a little sadness in their story.
Yeah.
And yet they go forward. They go on, you know, day by day. Eventually they, if you keep on living, you keep on going. So
Stephen tells her that if she cleans up the house, she'll be able to, here's how he puts it, see your way to the deeper issues.
Right.
Do you think that has been true in your own exploration? You know what I mean? That whatever these, no matter how trivial those mm-hmm. little Easter eggs that you found along the way yourself,
mm-hmm.
no matter how trivial they were or strange they might have been, because we've all found those weird things, you know,
right.
behind some wall somewhere. That they made you think in a deeper way about life?
Well, sure. I think there's a sense of connection. I think that a home is really a sanctuary. It's a place I feel like you can be your truest self. And think about the times that you spend in your home walking through the same hallways or looking out the same windows and things like that. And then you realize that every single person in every single home at every single age has the same experience. It's the place where you can let your hair down. And all of those items that we purchase and create on, you know, or save on Pinterest or whatever to create our home as our own personal space, they're important to every person in their own way. And so I think that, yeah, you have to, I think it gives you a broader perspective that everybody has a story.
Yeah. Ivy remembers first seeing the house on Downington. Talks about having, this is how you put it, starry-eyed notions about living in a historic house.
Yeah.
Is that you?
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
I bought the house for the porch swing. I'm not going to lie.
So tell me about your house. And I wonder how the house that you created, this house for the novel is not the same. It's on Downington. You don't live on Downington. But how close to the original is it? And how much of that house as you were writing the novel? Did you have to really, like, did you have a house in mind? Do you know what I mean? Like a photo or something?
Oh, well, I mean, I'd have to say that probably a lot of the features that you find in this fictionalized house are features that you would find in my own home, sure. I had a tiny tidbit of actual history that was given to me by my real across-the-street neighbor. His name is George Pearson, and he's actually the only character that is not fictional in this story. And he lived in his house for over 50 years. And, you know, every day he would go out in the front yard, and he would smoke a cigarette, and he would look across the street at my house. And I just wondered at all the change that he'd seen through the years. And it was fascinating to me because I couldn't imagine living in a home for as long as he did. So I guess I would say that he gave me the tidbit about one of the characters. He said there was a Greek family that lived there, and that they had bottled wine in their basement, which gave me the character of Eris, which is a Greek immigrant, and they do that in their basement. Then I did research. My home isn't necessarily historically significant, and so it gave me a lot of latitude to imagine. And that was the joy of it, is that I could take and create these stories, I guess, from my own mind.
Yeah. What was the research like? Is it difficult? I mean, it's one of the things we'll come back to here on the program, because I think it's interesting for people who have tried this. Mm-hmm. And those who haven't, wanting to know where you start, what you do.
Well, first of all, the internet is an amazing resource. I don't know how people wrote historical fiction before they had access to it. And then thank you to every single person who takes the time to put those things, to digitize the documents, to write articles, because it's so important. But if you want to go look for the physical things, you can go to the Utah State Historical Society, and they have all sorts of, paper documents, but now so many things are actually online. And so the most interesting part for me was to go through and look at photos of my neighborhood and try to, I guess, imagine what it would look like at the time. But I would take the skeleton of that from whatever photos I could find. So I would see that the roads weren't paved in 1913, or I'd see there was a trolley line that went down the middle of the road, or there were absolutely no trees, but a lot of telephone poles, and the sidewalks were laid, but there were no houses along the streets. So those things were fascinating to me. Then I worked on writing the story, and then I went back in and tried to fill in a lot of those historical details after that.
There's this Adam thinks early on, obviously in the novel, somebody had removed the window seat in the dining room.
Right.
And at this part in the book, Ivy asks, what would possess someone to make such a dramatic alteration to such a lovely old house? Mm-hmm. Which, this sounds like you too, right? I mean, you're talking about dropped ceilings and tearing off amazing, what, probably gumwood.
Gumwood built-ins.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Everyone did that. Mm-hmm. And then we went through that horrible period in the 70s and the 80s where you popcorn ceilings and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I guess it's frustrating, but I wonder if you came to terms with the fact that people wanted to alter something for themselves.
I came to terms with it because I was doing it myself.
Exactly, right?
Right. And so as much as I wanted to make it look historically accurate, I can't afford new gumwood built-ins. They don't even make gumwood built-ins anymore.
No, I don't think you can find gumwood anymore. Maybe you can, but it's expensive.
It's expensive,
sure.
No.
So you've checked.
I checked into it, and no, I absolutely came to terms with it. But I did really wonder what would inspire that. And I think that there are, so the character that I had tearing out the window seat she was doing it in kind of a fit of anger, trying to control her circumstance. Her son was over in World War II, and she was trying to control anything she could in her life. And I think that a lot of times, and I don't know if this is commonplace, but I find painting very therapeutic. Mm. And if I have something that I need to think over or work through or whatever, then suddenly there's a room in my house that needs a fresh coat.
Yeah.
And so I just imagine that if people were making these changes in their homes, there probably was, first of all, something going on in their lives. And second of all, maybe they were doing it for therapy. So
they were living their lives.
They were living their lives, and at the same time, creating a space that was uniquely their own.
Yeah. I'm going to have you read a section from the book. And this is a moment. Set this up for us, because it's a kind of an intriguing moment. And I think a lot of us, as I mentioned before, have had these experiences where we found something. Mm-hmm. Set this part up for us, if you would.
Okay, sure. So this is Ivy's section, and she's the modern-day character. She has just started Adam has passed away. It's early in the book, and she is starting to realize that she is going to be doing some changes on her home. And so she has gone through and done some remodeling already, and the things that she would find, she would call Easter eggs. And she also knew about there's a historic rose bush or heirloom rose bush in her home that she had heard from a neighbor was called the Emmeline Rose. And she had wondered who this Emmeline character was. She heard she was an early owner of the home. So this is when she discovers an Easter egg that reveals just part of Emmeline's story. I shook my head to clear the thought and considered the little case. What secret could it contain? Hopefully nothing gory. It was too small to hold a body, which is some relief. Finally, no longer able to stand the suspense, I took a deep breath and flipped the latch. Folded tightly at the bottom was a piece of muslin yellowed with age. Pulling it out, I straightened the folds on a piece of embroidery. An image of the Salt Lake City Temple, the original temple built by the first Mormons in my town, had been meticulously completed, and in an arc above the temple were the words, "Sealed for time and all eternity." Below the temple were two names looped together with embroidered vines and flowers, Emmeline and Nathaniel, and the year, 1916. The names were roughly written in pencil, the stitches covering the script only half complete. Emmeline, the girl of the rose. It was hers. Caressing the colored floss, I held the muslin close, marveling anyone could produce such evenly spaced, tiny stitches with needle and thread. This embroidery should have been a wall hanging, a lovingly made memento celebrating a longed-for wedding day, but it was only half complete. Why would Emmeline hide away an unfinished statement of her love? What could have happened? Adam, she's the girl who planted our rose bush. I know she is. I searched the ceiling, speaking aloud now, looking for him. I have an idea. Find Emmeline up there, wherever you are, and tell her I found her embroidery and I want to know what happened with this Nathaniel guy. Adam didn't answer me yet again, but this incomplete handwork told me Emmeline had a story of her own. Relieved to take a break from the sad twist in my own tale, I was more than eager to consider hers.
LaJoy Olson is with us. Her book is Root, Petal, Thorn. She has a new book called Where the Sweet Bird Sings, which is due out in August. She's joining us here today, and we're going to take a quick break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the story of your house. If you live in an old one, maybe you found clues to the lives of the people who came before, or maybe you've done the research and you know the stories. This is the basic idea behind LaJoy Olson's first novel. It's an imagined genealogy of her house. She explores the lives of five women who occupied the same space over the course of 100 years. And we're using the book as kind of a jumping off point for a conversation about how the permanence of places and the impermanence of people affects our lives. LaJoy Olson is with us again. Her novel is called Root, Petal, Thorn. Joining us is Susan Matt, chair of the history department at Weber State University. She's written a lot about the idea of home, and she has a book called Homesickness in American History. She was on the program talking about that a while back. And Susan Matt, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Bim Oliver is with us. He's a consultant specializing in historic preservation and economic development. He's written a book called South Temple Street Landmarks, Salt Lake City's First Historic District. And Bim Oliver, welcome to you.
Thanks, Doug.
I want to begin. This is like such a very broad question, but we'll drill down on it. But Susan, let me ask you first, what effect does a house have on your life?
Well, I think it can be a way to establish roots sometimes when you don't have any of your own. It can be a place that's permanent. You buy it, you move into it. It grounds you, even if you're a newcomer to an area. It gives you an anchor. So I think a lot of people for the last couple centuries in America have relied on houses to give them a sense of permanence when maybe other things in their lives are in flux.
We've talked a little bit about this, but I want the importance of a structure, of a house, right?
Yeah.
Is that a particularly American thing? I mean, I guess it's not just an American thing, obviously, but for Americans, this is a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, Americans have one of the highest rates of home ownership in the world. It's very important for us to live in houses, more so than in apartments, which you see much more in Europe. People really want to kind of have a stake, even if they're going to move into it and move out of it again and move on to someplace else. The idea of a home is very much central to American culture. And I think in some ways it's kind of an invented tradition.
What do you mean?
Well, in the 19th century, people are kind of appalled at how restless Americans are. In some years, more than 50% of the population is moving out of one state and into another.
Yeah.
And there are all these moralists and sermon writers and architects saying, this is bad for the country. We're not going to be good citizens if we're constantly in movement. Maybe we need to build houses that are more beautiful, that will ground us. And there's this whole kind of literature devoted to what would a good house look like that would make you want to stay put.
Right.
And interestingly, I mean, it would have ivy on it because that makes it look like it's been there a long time.
Yeah,
it would be stone. It would be charming. It would have a picket fence. So there are all these visual details that would supposedly make people want to put down roots and stay planted.
Can I add to that?
Of course,
just a little bit?
Yeah.
Because you mentioned that sort of this idea of home is I'll say contrived. And certainly we have policies at the federal level in particular that have for many years encouraged home ownership. So we have this stimuli, not only sort of these social and cultural mores, I guess, that encourage us to be in a home or in a permanent place, if you will, but also there are policies that are encouraging us to do the same. So there's a lot of energy focused on buying a house and being in a house and staying in a house that really encourages that here, probably more so than in other parts of the world.
When I first moved into my house, and my house is, it was 1926, so it's an old house, also in the Sugar House area. Mm-hmm. So I can totally relate to Ella's story. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about it, really. I knew a couple of basics, and I have to say I still can't say I know all that much about a couple, I take that back. But I didn't know anything about the original owners, put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what difference do you think it makes to know the history, the story of a house? Bim?
Well, I think it makes a difference to the extent that knowing any history makes a difference. Mm-hmm. I was thinking a lot about that question on the way over because an intuitive response to that, an emotional response perhaps, that we become more connected to the places that we live in, not just houses, but any places where we exist, so to speak. We're in office buildings, we're in churches, we're in schools, we're in grocery stores. Mm-hmm. To the extent that we know the stories of those places, we are more connected to those places. And I think collectively, we have a better understanding of what we want our broader places, our neighborhoods, our communities to be if we understand where those places came from. But the bottom line is it's interesting. It really is. The research, doing any of this kind of research is kind of addictive. For your listeners who've done any genealogy research, for example, it's the same kind of thing where you find facts and they lead you to more questions and you just sort of go on and then your spouse comes and yanks you away from your computer for a while.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. More than anything else, I would say it's just interesting.
I know, for example, a woman, an elderly woman, died of natural causes in the house. Marie, mm-hmm. know her name. And I feel a kind of strange kinship with her. We do, my wife and I, in that house. And always asking questions whether you figure Marie might approve of, and Walter and Marie, if maybe they might approve of something you're thinking about doing. And I don't know, I wanted to have you say something about that. Susan, like that obligation that we feel once we lose our innocence and learn the actual story of a place.
Yeah, you know, I mean, in some ways, I think because Americans move so much, we end up not living the places our own parents and grandparents lived, but we almost adopt the prior owners as our own kin because of our rootlessness. So they're stand-in relatives. And so you feel like you're part of a lineage, even if it's not a blood lineage. Maybe it's a stone and brick lineage. And yeah. So, yeah, there is a sense of, well, I'm going to take this down, and I know they put it up, but I really hate it, but I'll keep this. And
yeah.
And there's some sort of fidelity to a tradition, maybe not quite a family tradition, but it does feel like that. And I think it's because we are so migratory, so peripatetic, that we want to feel connected to somebody before us and a shared space. And
yeah.
So we imagine into the minds of the people who saw the same doorways and windows that we do.
What do you think about that?
You know, I was thinking as Susan was talking about our own house. I know a little bit about it. I mean, I suppose ironically, I haven't done the intensive research on
my own
house.
Is that right? I would have thought you would have known everything about your house.
So I don't know if that disqualifies me or not. But I did run across, this actually had to do with a project that we were working on. And I ran across some information on our property line. And one of the previous owners had purchased about a foot of property in the neighboring lot to the south. And I thought, why would you do that? I mean, that in and of itself was intriguing, and I kind of wanted to pursue it. I suppose his children or his children's children are still around, and they could maybe tell me about that, although maybe that's just lost to the fog of time. But even that little sort of bit of information makes you think more about where you are. And certainly we've made a lot of changes to our house, and you do think when you're making changes about kind of what you're undoing to some extent, and there is a sort of an impermanence to it, and my wife and I talk about this when we move out of our house, whether all of our work is going to be undone as well.
Will you leave something behind on purpose?
Yeah.
Did
you, by the way?
Well,
that's
such a good
idea.
I haven't moved out of my house
no,
yet.
No, right.
Well.
But along the way, as you were renovating, you didn't tuck anything into the wall?
Oh, we've written a few things
have
here
you?
And there. Yeah, we have. I mean, you know, but they're deeply hidden. The secrets need to remain for a while. But yeah, I mean, behind boards or before we paint a wall or carved into concrete underneath a workbench or whatever. Yes.
We actually, when we first moved into our house, we remodeled the basement, and we were removing the paneling in the basement, and we ran across literally tons of BBs. So there was clearly some kind of military action going on in the basement for a long time before we moved in. So, you know, you'll find things like that, you know, who was shooting BBs, I don't know, but those little things tell you a lot about what was going on in that space, and it does inform how you interact with the space as well, I think.
How though? How do you think it affects? I was just saying, honestly, I do feel a different sense of reverence about our house right now than I did before. Not having a clue about them at all made it different. And I do wonder, because we've done our share of renovations, if I would have done things differently or would have done them at all, knowing, you know, again, the real story.
Yeah, and you know that there was kind of probably a unifying vision
yes.
for each occupant. Like,
yep.
I want this hardwood, yep. and I want these curtains. And but then some things age better than others out of that vision, right?
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
so.
Or fatigue with the place as it exists. You know, it seems like it's old and out of date and maybe a little run down and a few things are broken and your neighbor across the street just got something that was really snazzy. And so you decide you're going to put that in. And I do see that along my street, a lot of additions were probably made at a similar time. I think it was a time when they were digging out basements.
Yeah.
And so then they added a little, you know, back area, back room that will allow a staircase to go down to that basement. And nearly every home that the same age as mine on my street has the same addition. And I'd imagine that, I mean, you could see the, you know, the ladies standing out on their porches, and I don't mean just ladies, of course, you know, men as well, thinking, well, I want a basement.
Yeah.
And so then going out and having that, you know, remodeled or asking about the contractor and having those changes made. So,
Pim, I wanted to ask you about what Ella, you said, I think gets to something that I've been wondering about. And it may go to what has changed with South Temple, because you've looked at those grand and wonderful houses along
right.
South Temple. We kind of go through phases, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a phase, I'm not sure when it was, when people were just tearing those houses down.
Yeah, there's the changes that occurred, especially to the grand estates on South Temple, Those are the places I think that most people think of when they think of South Temple. The changes that occurred there were actually relatively complex, and they were in many ways more about economics than they were about anything else.
You mean that was a snapshot that told you about what was going on at the time, economically?
Kind of, sort of. I mean, basically, a lot of those changes occurred as a result of downturns in the mining industry. The Great Depression, of course, played a big role. And something that's been mentioned earlier, too, is that if I move... For our children don't live with us anymore, I guess, and certainly our son doesn't live with us anymore. He has his own house. When we pass away, he's not necessarily going to want to hold on to our house. And I think the same would be true regardless of how grand or elaborate your house is. It becomes, to some extent, almost a liability for your children. So they would be likely to sell it. Once you sell a property, the potential for it to turn over to something else increases. So there were factors like that that were going on that I guess I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as a phase, but more of an evolution, that the changes that were occurring, they were really kind of natural outcomes of what was happening on a broader scale economically, to some extent socially, but certainly economically.
Do you think that we are more respectful these days? I know we like to think of ourselves as so much more enlightened than the knuckleheads who tore down a beautiful mansion on South Temple in the 60s or whenever it was. But I wonder if that's true. You know what I mean? We absolutely respect historical homes in a way, but we still want to tear out, you know, dig out the basement.
Right, or update the kitchen. I mean, nobody wants to cook in a kitchen that was built in 1900. I mean, that's just not—it's not feasible, and it's a little gross. But I think that people respect it quite possibly because enough time has passed that the old things are cool again.
Yeah.
And I even see that the resurgence of that in mid-century modern dwellings, which when I was growing up in the 70s, we looked at those homes and thought, "Eh, you know, who would want to live there?" And now.
They're cool.
Everything that was in my grandparents' house, yep. You know, I suddenly wish, you know, we hadn't mocked throughout the years that they
You have to go down
there.
To the Green Ant and buy it.
Exactly. Yeah. And now it costs like, you know,
exactly
25 times the original value. But yeah, so I think that a certain amount of time passing, old is new again in some ways.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I think there's also a way that the baby boom generation really kind of drove this. They rejected tradition in the 60s and 70s. And then when they started settling down and having families, they were the people who wanted to go to Restoration Hardware when it still was a thriving business. They were the ones who were avidly reading Martha Stewart and trying to create this imagined home, the stability, the look, the feel, the smell with cinnamon and hazelnuts or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, we had this mid-century modern phase, which probably started in the 30s before, you know, that high 1950s modernism. And then it kind of peaked, and starting in the 80s and 90s, we returned to tradition. I'm not convinced that we won't have some other knuckleheads come along somewhere in the 21st century and say, oh, this old stuff our parents liked, that was horrible. So I wish it weren't so, but I have a feeling there'll be some more destruction along the way.
But I guess what it shows is that our own sensibilities – Our relationship to tradition, to the past, to wanting something new is reflected in the way we treat our houses, I guess.
Yeah. I remember reading about Celebration, Florida, which is one of those – it's like Daybreak, Utah. You know, one of those new old neighborhoods. And people were moving from all over the country to settle in Celebration, Florida so they could have the look of an old-fashioned, long-rooted neighborhood, even though – they were having to uproot their lives and be new migrants to these old-fashioned-looking places.
Isn't that ironic?
Yeah, and one of them was saying, well, we were restless and always rootless, so we wanted to move again to put down roots, right?
I mean, to this kind of Disney view of Americana.
Yeah, and I think Daybreak has some of that same tradition. And I like the idea of front porches and walkable communities that it tries to bring back. But I think there is a hunger sometimes that comes out of a particular moment in a culture, and different generations are going to react differently to it and not share that. Some may want the new and the modern and want to dispense with these old-fashioned ways.
I wonder if part of it, too, is that what we thought we wanted was the porch. But the essence of the porch wasn't so much the porch, although that was an architectural feature. It was the neighbors were walking by and you got to say, hey, how are you guys doing? You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't the thing, because you can redo a porch. It was the connection.
The community.
Yeah.
The community.
It became a symbol for that.
Right. And I think the porch went out of style when everybody started driving and pulling into their garages and walking in their back doors.
And getting air conditioning.
And getting air conditioning or the television. And then they were no longer sitting on their porch and needing to speak with their neighbors because they had everything, you know, inside their houses. So I think there is some nostalgia for that, for sure. For sure there was for me when I wanted my house that had a front porch.
This makes me think of George, your neighbor, who from across the street smoking a cigarette looked at your house for 50 years or whatever it was. And I guess you did. You, at some point you decided, I'm going to talk to George and see what he has to say about the neighborhood. And it just makes me think about this process of discovering what your house, the story of your house, is going to have to – it requires you to get outside and go talk to your neighbor, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Well, especially to discover your community. I'm sad to say that I didn't ask George enough questions before before he passed away. He gave me a few little tidbits, but you know, he was always a guy who was interested in what you were doing, and I was chasing after really little children at that time, and so you know, it was clear what I was doing, but he would just kind of come and hang around, and every now and then he'd give me just a little hint about what had been there.
Tidbit
that piqued my curiosity, but I didn't have time to follow up on it. However, his children have been very forthcoming. After I finished the book, I contacted them and said, hey, look what I've done. And I started getting letters and notes from them. So it's been really, really fun.
Let's take a break. Ella Joy Olson is with us. She's a novelist based in Salt Lake City, the author of the book we're talking about, Root, Petal, Thorn. Susan Matt is also here, chair of the history department at Weber State University, the author of the book Homesickness in American History. And we have Bim Oliver with us. He's a consultant specializing in historic preservation and economic development. He has a book, which you should check out. It has a lot of cool photos of some of the grand houses on South Temple. It's called South Temple Street Landmarks, Salt Lake City's first historic district. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the stories of our houses. It's basically what we're talking about. We have a jumping off point. It's Ella Joy Olson's novel, Root, Petal, Thorn. She's with us here, along with Susan Matt, chair of the history department at Weber State University, and Bim Oliver, who's a consultant specializing in historic preservation. Bim, I want to ask you, when you were doing research on South Temple, were there any like really tragic stories? I mean, there must have been more than a few of great houses or great moments that are just lost to history.
Well, there is one that comes to mind. I would say that I would probably refrain from using the word knuckleheads, I guess. But
okay. I can't help it.
My own perspective is that much of the change that occurred along South Temple and even the loss of some of the grand estates was healthy, and the many of the buildings that replaced them are truly significant in their own right. Yeah. Part of the issue, I think, one of the challenges is that buildings that are mid-century buildings typically aren't perceived as being historic. They don't look historic. They aren't maybe old enough. Maybe it's a little shock to some of us that we're as old as those buildings are, and we don't want to think of ourselves in those terms.
But they have architectural significance.
They have architectural significance, sure. But the building that comes to mind as sort of the tragic building, I suppose, or one of them, is the Judge Mansion, which was at 747 East South Temple. And it was in its day. There's a wonderful book, by the way, called Brigham Street, which is by Margaret Lester. It may not be in print anymore. It's relatively old. But and KUED has also run a documentary on that same period when the grand estates were built. But during its time, the Judge Mansion was sort of one of the places to go. It was one of the happening places. And when Mary Judge died, I believe her name was Mary Judge, her children inherited the mansion, and they weren't living here. Most of them were not even living in Salt Lake anymore. So there's sort of a what to do with this, and they held on to it for a little while, but eventually the value, the market value, if you will, of the property declined to the point where the assessed value, the tax value, was higher. So they did the math, and they decided to demolish the home because they just didn't want to pay taxes on it anymore. That's a tragedy. I mean, that raises a whole set of other questions for another show about things like tax policy and how does it affect real estate and so forth. But it was a kind of a sad story because I think there is, from my mind, a pretty cool building that's there now. But the fact that they had to demolish it and the reasons for the demolition must have been quite painful to them.
Let me ask you about those. We talked a little bit about this earlier with Ella, how you go about, how she went about doing the research. And we were talking off air a little bit about how much easier it is these days. Bim, say something about where you start.
Well, as I told you in the break, I start on my sofa.
Yeah.
And I get out my laptop. But there's quite a bit that's available online. And certainly I would hope that Ella and Susan would jump in on this too. But Ella mentioned earlier the state Historic Preservation Office has wonderful resources for somebody who wants to research their home. Ironically, I suppose, in my research, it's been easier, much easier for me to find information on older buildings than on relatively new buildings. Some of the buildings I was researching for the South Temple book that were constructed, say, in the 60s, much harder to find information on those.
Why, do you think?
Well, I think in the old days, say in the 1910s or even in the 1890s or perhaps even as late as 1930, when Salt Lake was growing, it was still kind of a cool thing to write about new buildings or new developments. And at a certain point, especially after World War II when we were growing so fast, it probably was not that exciting anymore to talk about a new housing development or a new office building or whatever. But there's a lot of information down at the State Historic Preservation Office. You can go to history.utah.gov to kind of get started. Newspapers of the time were really helpful to me in my research. Anecdotal stories, I mean, George's stories, they kind of pique your interest for sure. You have to be a little bit careful about personal anecdotes because sometimes they can be reliable and sometimes they may not. But they certainly can take you in certain directions that you might not go otherwise. And then just
at some point, don't you have to just concede that that's the case?
Like, yeah,
that sounds great.
Yeah,
may or may not be true, but yeah. I'll believe it for now.
And the anecdotal stories are the things that add, I guess, the richness to the story.
Yeah.
So if you can get a little bit of that along with the facts, you know, you look something up and then you continue your research. I think that that's what makes the story more, interesting.
And often they encapsulate some larger theme. You know, they're little representative nuggets that really open up a whole world to you. And so I always value those.
Yeah.
Susan, where do you, I'm not sure if you've ever done this kind of research. It's maybe not quite your sort of history, but as an historian, I guess you're looking for stories, right? It's not just the architectural details, although those are good, that's a good framework, I suppose.
Right. And I mean, on my own house, there's one owner and I know who it was, and it wasn't terribly hard to find that out. But, you know, I've been interested in architecture and the shape of home for a long time. So I'm always interested to, like, look at architectural pattern books, which were produced just at a phenomenal rate in the 19th and early 20th century, and then watch how they get kind of translated into Sugar House or the Avenues and all these styles that were popular nationally, and what the Utah twist on them is kind of interesting to look at. So while I haven't gone and investigated particular houses, I've been interested in how these styles get translated and what they say about a particular era's zeitgeist, I guess.
What's the Utah twist? Can you say?
Well, sometimes there'll be obvious things like polygamy houses where there are more doors or more wings. Sometimes it's just that you can see these builder books and they're kind of grand and things have been translated down to a smaller scale. And sometimes there are sort of perfect representations of what you see in you know, Tudor Revival style books or Greek Revival. That was something I was really interested in. I went to grad school in upstate New York, and there were Greek Revival houses all over the landscape. And then coming out to Utah and finding the same styles here was kind of comforting, even though I was not from New York and I wasn't from Utah, I was surrounded by the same the same style.
Yeah. Well, they have a catalog, architectural catalogs, where people could go in and they could purchase a floor plan and have everything delivered with their pre-cut lumber.
Like a Sears house.
Exactly, yeah. Like a Sears house. And as we were talking about those gumwood built-ins, I have one of those architectural catalogs, and you could get all your gumwood built-ins for about, oh, I don't know, $1.75.
And it makes you sick, doesn't it?
It makes you sick.
Yeah.
One Utah twist that people might not think about because it's so prevalent here is that there's a lot of masonry here. We have a lot of brick and stone. Mm-hmm. And the reason is there isn't a lot of wood. I mean, there wasn't a lot of readily available wood. So homes that might have been built in frame, you know, out of wood in other parts of the country probably would have been built in stone or brick here. And I think that also gets to the issue of Mormon migration and the fact that there was sort of a recruitment effort to bring Masons into the state because we were going to build stuff out of brick and stone. So there's a little bit of a materials twist, I guess, to what we see here that we might not see otherwise.
I wanted to ask about what you're seeing in, and Elle, I'm sure you see this in your neighborhood. I see it in mine. People who are the older styles are appealing to them, but they need more space or they want to update it. Mm-hmm. What's the proper way to go about that? Bim, let's start with you.
I was hoping you'd start with Ella.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I saw you nodding your head.
Well, you know, I guess I'll start with just a brief philosophical statement. There is a balance, obviously. We talked earlier about respecting the building, again, whether it's a home or some other building, respecting where it comes from. And the ideas that were built into the house. You know, I think that buildings do need to evolve, and we've done quite a bit with our interior space that, quite frankly, isn't necessarily true to the original design of the home. And I think that's, to some extent, the nature of it. Coming from a historic preservation background, that's probably sort of bordering on heresy, I guess. But we do need to find a way to allow buildings to evolve, allow them to become more livable, so to speak, and yet at the same time maintain the integrity of the building that communicates all those values that we've been talking about all along.
At what point do you disrupt that? You know, at what point do you, like, now that you completely compromised the sense of a building?
You know,
that's such a subjective idea.
It can be difficult. You know, there are standards that have been produced by the National Park Service that are relatively general in nature that kind of give you a sense of when you might be hitting those boundaries, but still, it is, it can be a subjective determination. Our house was painted. It was originally a brick house when we bought it. It had been painted. Seems like a minor change, but, you know, now it's a painted house. It's not a brick house anymore. I mean, it's still made of brick, but it doesn't communicate those same values that it communicated when it was built originally. You know, to the owners, that was probably a nice thing to do. It was probably a nice update. But the reality is that stepping over that line?
Yeah.
Kind of a tough call.
It's a part of making it your own, just like making any space your own. And I think that each person who makes those changes kind of craves to leave their mark and kind of imbue the space with who they are. This is kind of a broader view, but something that I think is kind of interesting. If you take a look at the Greek ruins, and they're kind of in there at this point in their original state. I mean, not they're run down and things like that, but it's not a living history. They're captured in a way that shows what they were, or tries to show what they were like when they were built, versus going to someplace, say in Paris, like the Notre Dame Cathedral, and you see that the it's living history there, and each layer adds a little bit of interest and significance. And you know, through all of those centuries, people were creating history, and now as we look back through all those layers of time, each of them has a special place. So you wouldn't want it to look necessarily exactly like it did when it was first built, because part of the intrigue is what happened to it from that point forward.
Susan, what are you seeing when you look at neighborhoods, some of them being renovated, people tearing houses down? Can you give us a sense of, do you see an attitude? Do you see something reflected in the way we're building these days?
I think we're still fascinated with the return to the past, and we have been for about 20 or 30 years. So
we're still on that.
Yeah. I mean, maybe Restoration Hardware is not doing the thriving business it was 15 years ago, but you still look at what's being built and in what styles, and it's still retro. And in America, retro can be going back to the 60s, it can be going back to the 40s, it can be going back to the 20s.
But we're always going back to something.
We're going back. We're not really building the futuristic houses of the 50s or 60s that our parents and grandparents were. So I think we still have this backward-looking house fascination. And I think sometimes we're trying to recapture these moments we think existed in great purity. And just kind of thinking about Elle's comment that, you know, even the first owner of your house no doubt made changes within his or her lifetime. And so sometimes I think we're trying to recapture and cast in amber a style that maybe was more malleable. But in any case, I think the backward-looking trend hasn't abated. And some of that's, I think, really good. New urbanist architecture, which has, as we talked about, brought back the porch, but also brought back kind of a more communal feel to a lot of neighborhoods. I think what you were saying before about trying to not just recapture a style, but a way of life is something that's animating a lot of homeowners and town planners.
That's Susan Matt. She's chair of the history department at Weber State University. She has a book called Homesickness in American History. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bim Oliver is a consultant specializing in historic preservation and economic development. His book, which you should check out, has cool photos, South Temple Street Landmarks, Salt Lake City's First Historic District. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
Very much for being with us. And Ella Joy Olson, you should check out her novel. It's called Root, Petal, Thorn. She has a new one, by the way. I should just mention Where the Sweet Bird Sings. It's due out in August. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.